Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program today, money, power and algorithms as global investors redraw the map at Davos. From cash to clicks as South Africa's payment habits change faster than regulation. Europe shuts the door and Africa's gas opportunity swings wide open. And your social media posts could cost you in court even before you know it. It's Wednesday, the 21st of January. The World Economic Forum in Davos is buzzing, but three forces are cutting through the noise right now. Geopolitics, with Donald Trump speaking and Greenland dominating, I would imagine, corridor chatter. Artificial intelligence reshaping capital flows faster than policy can keep up. And also a renewed question over where Africa and South Africa fit into global portfolios. So let's discuss where investors, where the smart money is looking. I'm joined by Chris Holdsworth, Chief Investment Strategist at Investec. Chris, welcome. Greenland, I think it's fair to say, has become the unexpected headline at Davos this week. What is it telling you about how geopolitics is being priced by markets right now?
Yeah, Jeremy, I think that's exactly the story. I mean, the Greenland story is dominating everything at the moment. President Trump due to speak today. I think the underlying story is the market reaction. We heard from senior representatives from Canada, from China, from Europe, all pleading for a rules-based order and for a return to how things were prior to April last year. And with all this uncertainty, we saw a sell-off in the market yesterday, as expected. What was unusual is that the dollar weakened and treasury yields went up. The U.S. is not acting like the safe haven that it did before. And that's a problem for investors. We don't have that bucket being an effective safe haven in the same way that it did before. And we have to find other alternatives, or we're all going to be shifted up the risk curve. And I think that's going to be the key talking point for markets as a result of this for the next 6 months or at least.
Chris, is there a sense that we're starting now then to see a move from rules-based, as you put it, globalization, to more power-based deal-making? And obviously, if that's the case, it's going to change risk modeling.
That's exactly what's happening. And it's certainly the talk. I mean, you talk to a lot of foreign investors around on the streets, and the sentiment you've described is exactly the sentiment that's repeated on the streets, and I think it's a broad-based concern at this point.
When you talk about a broad-based concern, it's a cheap question always, but the mood this year, perhaps compared to previous years, is it more somber? Is there a great deal more seriousness, not only in the formal conversations on the stages, but on the sidelines?
I think it's a combination of anxiety and frustration. Anxiety, because we're not sure what President Trump is going to say and the associated concerns around the market reaction, but also frustration because there's a lot of other things that are happening here. There's a lot of other stories that are simply being pushed into the sidelines because the Greenland story is dominating absolutely everything at the moment.
So in this environment then, Chris Holdsworth, which assets or regions become geopolitical hedges rather than growth plays? In other words, how's the economic landscape shifting in the short to medium term?
Yeah, this is an opportunity for some of the second-tier safe havens. A country like Japan, as an example, which traditionally has been a safe haven asset, hasn't been of late, could well pick up that mantle again. This is obviously an opportunity for a country like Switzerland, which has been a traditional safe haven. And other countries that are on the edge may well have a chance here, but I don't think anybody's going to fully be able to replace what we had from the US up until April last year.
So that's the big geopolitical issue. The other one is artificial intelligence. I would imagine it's everywhere at the World Economic Forum. What is the general sense from the investment community, Chris? Are they treating AI as an infrastructure rather than just a tech theme, which was maybe the case a year or two ago?
I think we're getting to the point where there's increasing concern around the speed at which AI is being developed. I mean, I attended a talk yesterday around how AI can be used by hackers and how it raises information security issues. And there's concerns around what it means for employment going forward. So I think the narrative has shifted a little bit from optimism last year around the potential benefits for society to now being what could the knock-on consequences could be. And maybe this is just a reflection of the anxiety around Greenland, but it does seem like the narrative is shifting away from optimism to pessimism in general.
Well, let's talk about those knock-on effects. There's a sense as well, I imagine, that AI would deepen the gap between capital-rich countries and emerging markets such as ours. Or, more optimistically, Chris, do you think that there is an opportunity that it might just level the playing field?
The general view from the people I've been speaking to here is that it's going to heighten inequality. There might be universal basic income grants, but they'll be different across countries. And even in the countries that they are deployed, we're just going to land up with people that own assets that inevitably will be much wealthier than the people that don't. So the inequality issue is coming up a lot. Maybe it's premature, but I think the general view is that it's going to be a more unequal society going forward.
If that's the case, what's the sense then about the AI winners emerging? Is it productivity? Is it defense, energy, health, data? Where's the needle moving?
It's everything. I mean, every single sector that you have some interaction with here is talking about AI and how AI is going to improve or threaten their industry. So it's across the board.
Let's turn to Africa. I did mention that at the start of our conversation. The biggest misconception that global investors are still bringing to the continent. Chris Holdsworth, has the conversation, has the perception changed in any way?
Yes, I think so. There's actually been a lot of optimism about Africa in particular. There's been quite a few talks about the African Continent Free Trade Agreement and how it's taken 5 years to get the paperwork done, and now they're on the hard work about improving logistics. We've chatted to logistics companies which are keen to do that work. There's talk about improving the cross-border exchanges or the places where you cross over the border and helping with currency exchanges too. So there's a lot of work being done. And I mean, you chat to some of the guys here around the potential for growth, and Africa grows at 3.5% at the moment. People were talking to say that could go up to 5 to 7% if you get this right. And in a global environment where there's a lot of anxiety and concerns around low growth, I think there's more and more attention being placed on the opportunities that Africa provides.
That's the continent. What about South Africa then? Is it being priced as a risk or maybe something which is cheaper with a little bit of upside if the global cycle turns?
I think there's still quite a bit of skepticism about the South African recovery story, despite the data. But what's interesting is there's been a hang of a lot of interest in SA. I was at the South African dinner last night. It was 2 times oversubscribed. I mean, I spent quite a bit of time at SA House, the place that the South African delegation rents out. Regularly, they've been over the maximum number of people allowed in the room. So I don't know if it translates to investment, but there's certainly a lot of interest in SA at this point.
So what are they looking for then? Is it the broad political landscape? Is it a little bit more stability when it comes to power and water? Is there more reform momentum that they're looking at, or a combination of all of it?
I think it is a combination. I think investors have been surprised by the extent to which we have seen successful reform, if you think of electricity and ports as an example. And they're just looking to see a bit more of it, you know, another 6 months to 12 months of providing delivery like that. And I think we're going to see investors taking the SA growth story quite seriously.
So just a final question then. If you had to tell investors one thing to watch over the next 12 months that might surprise them about the continent or even this country, what's the message that you're going to take back?
On the continent, it would be just watch out for foreign interest, which up until now has been quite muted. And on the first point, we spoke about geopolitics. Watch out for the Japanese 10-year bond yield, because it could provide an alternative to treasuries.
Chris Holdsworth, Chief Investment Strategist, Investec, talking to me from Davos in Switzerland. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africans, I read, are tapping, swiping and clicking more than ever. And a new PayFast State of Pay 2025 report arguing that this just isn't convenience. It's becoming a growth lever for small business. The claim is striking. Many merchants say going digital lifted sales sharply, while tools like Buy Now, Pay Later are gaining ground fast. But I think there's also a harder question here about fees, about fraud, about debt, and who really benefits when commerce goes cashless. And someone well positioned to Join the debate is Mpho Sadiki from PayFast. And let's bring the numbers down to earth. Mpho, a very warm welcome. Your report says 64.9, let's say 65% of merchants saw sales revenue rise by up to 50%, 35% seeing even higher gains. What's most believable here? Is it more customers, bigger baskets, fewer failed payments, or maybe something else?
I think it's a bit of both. Definitely, we're seeing that more and more customers are adopting digital payments and really finding the convenience of buy line and really engaging with digital commerce. And secondly, there are more options for them to pay, right? As you rightly said in your introduction, customers are not only limited to paying with just their card to complete e-commerce payments, but they have options like, the digital mobile wallets, your Apple Pay, Samsung Pays, and most recently, what we refer to as embedded finance products. So yes, is you're seeing customers having more options to pay, thus you see growth in actual customer numbers. And secondly, you also, as I said, a bit of both, is that baskets in general are also increasing. And I think these different mobile payment options do allow for customers to take up a little bit more than what they would have traditionally done. And I think buy now, pay later does also provide that opportunity.
Let's get to buy now, pay later in just a moment. But let me try and challenge the premise if I can. How do we know it's digital payments that are driving growth rather than simply a business that is already doing well just being more likely to adopt them?
Yeah, I think the beauty about digital payments is that it's borderless, right? It's the fact that even if you had a business and you were doing well, but you were locally focused and really you were not exposed to digital commerce, is that your customers are limited to the shop that you are selling from. But the minute you move to online and the minute you get exposed to online payments, your options, the options for your customers to pay you actually opens up, right? So in a shop, on average, people are traditionally limited to two options to pay you, card or cash, right? But once you move online, those options are more than just card and cash. And we've seen card, it knows not only just a physical card, but multiple iterations or forms of payment of card that are presented. And in addition, it's the EFT. So I hold the view that digital payments and digital commerce does drive growth in the sense that it opens up your market, right? It's just not only that you reach more customers in many places, but also the customers that engage with you are not limited to one or two forms of payment. So your chances of dropping transactions and missing out on a sale are typically minimal.
Let me ask you about buy now, pay later, doubling from 3% to 6% in online preference in just 12 months. Mpho, is that genuine demand or maybe, as I suspect, just aggressive marketing and default options at checkout?
I think it's a genuine demand. And yes, marketing and product placement and promotion will always drive adoption, right? That's why they're done and they're there. But the response from customers shows that there is demand for customers to spread what they are buying over a set period of time and really put a bit of cushioning to their wallets, right? So this is why I say there is a bit of genuine demand from customers that are saying, I could buy the same thing, I could pay for it up front, but if there is an option for me to split that 2,000 Rand payment over four equal installments, I will do that this time around. And yes, it's not for everything and anything. What we're seeing is that it's, yes, mostly in the retail, commerce space. It's mostly on physical goods that are, of high value, where customers see you in splitting those payments over that period. Yeah.
I'll take the point, but we've also got to be cautious that it can become a debt trap, and a degree of responsibility surely sits with merchants and payment providers.
Correct. And that's the thing that we always stay close to, is that yes, once it's okay, we must celebrate that when a payment method does see a level of adoption, but at the same time, we need to stay close to it to understand, is this introducing an additional credit burden to customers over a long period? I think the positive thing around it is that buy now, pay later at its core, it is still leveraging the existing credit capability that you have on your credit card or the card. And those assessments are done prior to you. So the fintech providers that are providing this product do check, you know, a level of affordability. So it's important that they don't put additional debt burden to customers. But you're quite right. It is something that we have to stay close to and ensure that it does not lead over time to increase credit burdens to customers.
And there's just one final question. There's also a potential ugly trade-off here where small businesses can get hurt in maybe a shift to digital, maybe in fees, maybe chargebacks, fraud, even load shedding or dependence on big platforms. And therein also lies a risk.
Correct. You know, one of the things that I've always said is that you know, what is important for both customers and merchants is a sense of security in the execution of the transaction. And where it's got to do with fraud, I think working with trusted partners like ourselves, who invest significant amount of our capital in ensuring that we stay one step ahead of fraudsters, is one. You know, I think you engage with people on the right side. But secondly, I do appreciate that fraud, especially in the age of AI, requires that digital companies like ourselves continue to invest capital to stay ahead of fraudsters. If we don't do that, yes, there is a very strong likelihood that we will lead or introduce a level of risk in the merchant ecosystem. But that's something that we pride ourselves in, is that we continuously put capital, put effort, put resources from either, you know, people, technology, to ensure that, one, we predict, we are able to pick up fraudulent transactions before they even happen. And then where they have happened, we ensure that we do the necessary recovery from both merchants and customers are impacted very minimally. So, yes, risk is always there in the ecosystem, but it is our duty and job to ensure that we invest in mitigating that risk for both the customers and the merchants, because it's a two-party transaction. Yeah.
Thank you very much for the honest assessment. That's Mpor Sadiki from PayFast. I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you might be aware that Europe's formal ban on Russian gas is now locked into law. And from this year, the European Union will be forced to redraw its entire energy supply map. It's an important issue because for Africa's major gas producers, it's being described as a once-in-a-generation opening. Europe needs reliable long-term suppliers, and African nations are positioning themselves to step in. But I imagine the opportunity also comes with a warning. Exporters must balance global demand with domestic development, ensuring that gas wealth powers African homes and industries and not just the security needs of Europe. So let's discuss that in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with N.J. Ayuk, who is Executive Chairman of the African Energy Chamber. N.J., a very warm welcome. So as I've mentioned, Europe's phase out of Russian gas is binding policy. Which African countries are then best positioned to meet Europe's immediate needs?
Thank you for having me on. I think you have African countries right there that are really moving to meet European needs, and some of them are less talked about. Big ones: Algeria, Nigeria, and Senegal, Mauritania with the GTA. They're moving there. Equatorial Guinea has slowed down, but 80% of its natural gas is going into Europe. But let's look at the future. Congo LNG, the Tango and Nguia coming out of the Republic of Congo, together with a project done by Eni from Italy, they are going to be moving a lot of gas into Europe. But that's also, let's look at the future. In the future, Mozambique LNG stands to really give Europe that big boost. That project in Cabo Delgado that has been stuck for years, but it's starting off. They got enough force majeure. And the Coral North and the Coral South in Mozambique also stand to really meet European security demands, and I think that works really well.
That's all well and good, but many African countries, as you've outlined to me, have these huge reserves, but I would also counter that there are chronic project delays. So what's the real barrier here? Is it finance? Is it political risk? Is it security issues, slow bureaucracy, or maybe a combination of all of that?
I think the biggest problem with African gas being developed right now, as we see it, is finance. Do not forget that in 2023, the Europeans branded natural gas as green energy, but it's green energy only for Europe, so they can finance it. It wasn't green, it's not green energy for Africa. So there's been a lot of background because of fossil fuels and climate change issues. There have been a ban on public financing of gas. And with the Net Zero Alliance, a lot of banks declined to finance natural gas projects. So you have gas, abundant gas all across Africa. Look at the Orange Basin in South Africa. Look at the Karoo. You can't get financing for that. And that is also becoming a problem because without financing, you can't develop this massive project that require $4 or $5 billion in investment. But we also have to do something in Africa ourselves. We have to look at our regulatory framework that has really held back gas development. That is a problem, and we need to fix that. So financing on one hand, but also regulation on another hand, that has become a barrier.
Where do you think the deficit is when it comes to the regulatory framework?
We need to cut red tape when it comes to approving projects, be it in South Africa, where you know you can't even shoot seismic or move with things with abundant gas. People don't understand, South Africa has more gas than even countries like Mozambique or Nigeria, but you cannot even touch it. It shouldn't take so long to approve a project in the time you need to build that project. That is basically what it is. And sometimes you had lawfare where you had NGOs from Western countries coming into places like South Africa, Mozambique, filing lawsuits just to delay the process or question any environmental impact assessment. So these kind of things stop or derail or slow down gas development. Don't forget, there's limited capital. But wherever you find capital, capital goes to where it's welcome. It goes to where people can move, their agile, their fast, streamlined regulatory process, permitting process is going better. So they look at Guyana, they look at Qatar, they look at other places like the UAE, and countries that are moving and have better processes. We move with that. We need to cut red tape and we need to cut the bureaucracy that has held down things because we already fighting for limited financing. But then if we add red tape and lack of transparency in the process, then it makes it even more difficult in a world where financing is tough for gas development.
Let me ask you a question about balance. There is, I imagine, always a tension between export and domestic need. And producers have got to try and prevent the old pattern where gas leaves the continent, but its citizens still sit in the dark. How do you find that equilibrium?
We need to have a healthy balance. We global energy security, but Africa is also part of the globe. So we also have to look at African energy security as well. We've had a history in my industry, and I'm not so proud of it, but where all the gas was shipped to Europe, to Asia, to America, and other places, except within the African continent. That doesn't help. Don't forget, we're in a continent where we have 600 million Africans without access to electricity, 900 million without access to clean cooking. They use biomass to cook, and most of them women. That is not good. If we are going to industrialize in Africa, you're going to need not just cheap energy, you're going to need affordable and abundant energy. And a lot of that comes from that base load, which is gas, if you're not going to use coal. So you have to export for global energy security, but you also have to think about African energy security, because that is very, very important. And I think that we need to change the thing on how we do this.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see how this debate plays out in 2026. NJ Ayuk, Executive Chairman, the African Energy Chamber, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, social media has become one of the biggest legal traps in modern litigation. Increasingly, Facebook posts, TikTok clips and WhatsApp voice notes and even fitness app location data being used in South African courts to challenge, weaken or completely destroy personal injury claims. I want to talk now to legal expert Kirsty Haslam, a partner at DSC Attorneys. And she says that claimants often have no idea how closely their online lives are scrutinized once a claim is filed. Kirsty, a very warm welcome to you. And your contention is that even a harmless holiday selfie can derail a multi-million rand injury claim. Tell me first how courts are increasingly using social media to undermine credibility or even prove exaggeration.
Well, good morning. Yes. The point is that posts like this have evidentiary value and can shed light on the validity of claims. So there was a recent matter, for example, where even though a Facebook account was hacked, the Eastern Cape High Court allowed that evidence to be admitted because it had probative value, which was directly relevant to what was at stake in the case.
Many people, of course, believe their social media is private, and that is the worst assumption you can make, I guess.
That is indeed the case, and this Harvey versus Nyland matter underscored that. It even said in that judgment that even though the hacking of the account probably amounted to criminal conduct in terms of the Electronic Communications and Transaction Act, it nevertheless was admissible in the context of the civil claim.
Which tells me, Kirsty, that it's very easy for insurers and lawyers these days to access content that often contradicts a claimant's story. And as I mentioned at the start of this conversation, this is happening more frequently, is it not?
Yes, it certainly is, and I've encountered that in my own personal practice. I nearly had a very significant claim derailed at the 11th hour at the end of last year because of a social media post, not even posted by the client, but which was factually incorrect and which related directly to her injury. And that had to be resolved very quickly in order to get the matter finalized.
And Kirsty, what is really staggering here is that often posts from friends or even family can be used as evidence. My question is, how big a risk is content that you don't control, particularly if you've been tagged in a video or a photo?
Yes, you do have to be vigilant about that, particularly in the context of a personal injury claim, because habitually defendants, insurers are doing those kind of internet searches to see what they can establish. And it can be very unfair, of course, and misleading, because let's be honest, we don't post the negative pictures of ourselves, do we? You don't post a picture of yourself in pain, but you could be innocently snapped at a family braai with a smile on your face, and that casts doubt on your assertion that you are depressed or in pain. So you do have to be vigilant, and I think we often are too relaxed, especially in the context of social pictures, that you have to give your permission for that picture to be published, and you need to be careful about that.
Often, if litigation begins, Kirsty, people's initial response, I guess, the instinctive response, is to delete content and delete it quickly. But you're going to tell me this move can backfire and maybe be interpreted as an attempt to conceal evidence.
Yes, it could be. It depends on the timing, of course. You know, if you've been seriously injured and you decide for good reason and on the advice of your attorney to no longer post on social media, that would be wise. If you are now 3 years into litigation and there's a history of posting and you then delete it, that might cast doubt on your credibility. And in any event, any defendant can actually call for discovery. It's called the discovery process in litigation. They can call for discovery of your social media posts so that they can see if there's anything relevant to the case.
Kirsty, what troubles me slightly is that unlawfully obtained content can be deemed admissible. Surely that is a misfit or a non-alignment with South Africa's privacy laws.
Well, it is a bit of an anomaly, and that was highlighted in the matter that I mentioned earlier. But what happened there is that Electronic Communications and Transactions Act, whilst it says that hacking and so on is a criminal offence, it's actually silent on the issue of admissibility. So what this case highlighted was that it can be both admissible whilst constituting a criminal act. It depends on the weight and probative value of that material. But what that case also did underscore is that totally irrelevant information had to be excluded.
How would you weigh that probative value, do you think?
Well, if it's directly relevant, so for example, let's assume your Facebook account has been hacked, but the material that the defendant wants to use is you ziplining on holiday, etc., whilst you're alleging that you have a serious back injury and you don't leave the house. So it's a court discretion at the end of the day. But if it's directly relevant to the issue in dispute, then it's probably going to be allowed as admissible.
Just a question on the path to admissibility. The rise in digital evidence that we're talking about, is it mostly driven by insurers themselves, or are courts becoming more proactive themselves in demanding social media disclosure?
Well, that wouldn't really be the appropriate role of the court. The court is supposed to be the dispassionate arbiter of fact and law. It really is driven by the defendants and insurers, and it has become the norm to immediately undertake social media investigations.
What is also interesting is that it's not just social media, but it's also fitness and location tracking apps.
Yes, that's true. There have been cases derailed by virtue of accessing fitness apps to, establish whether the person is really as immobile as is indicated. I actually managed to use, for example, Strava to my client's benefit in a particular matter. So it does work both ways.
So just a quick one. Is there a genuine way to stay safe online during a claim, or is the only realistic strategy to be completely silent on all social platforms?
I suppose complete silence is nearly impossible these days, but what one should be vigilant to do is to check your privacy settings and make sure that, I mean, how often do any of us actually do that, myself included? Check your privacy settings and make sure that it's restricted, and obviously don't accept invitations or friend requests and so on from persons unknown to you, because those could be investigators.
Well, you certainly have given us a profound warning. Kirsty Haslam, thank you very much indeed. Partner, DSC Attorneys, I do appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that's where we are going to leave it. You have been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.